Nice to be back in Auckland. Nice to see a couple of familiar faces in here. For those that don't know me, my name is Michael Frank. I'm a infrastructure cloud consultant working for Cloud with a K Solutions, and I'm based in Melbourne at the moment. I used to live up here. I used to live in Auckland. I used to live down in Wellington, so I know a few people around here. Also lived in Manila and done some work over there, and as I said, now I moved over to Australia. Our topic today is migration of your business to Office 365. It's a huge topic. It's quite big, and I had to narrow it down. Can't talk about everything, unfortunately. So I've narrowed it down to the most important things. So we're going to talk about how to get ready for Office 365. We are going to talk about identity, and then we're going to talk about mail migrations and mail migrations only. If you have any other questions or if you want to talk about anything else, feel free to approach me afterwards and we go and grab coffee and we can talk about data migrations, we can talk about SharePoint, OneDrive, Office Pro Plus, whatever you want. Cool. So what I want to get you to take away from the session is what do you need to consider when migrating to Office 365? Then again, we're going to talk about identity management, so we're going to talk about what the best identity option is for you. And lastly, we talk about all the mail migration options that there are, and I'll give you an overview of all of them. The agenda, introduction, right now. Woo-hoo, tick. Great. Going to talk about if you're ready to make the move. Talk about identity, as I said, going to talk about email migrations, and then IMAP, Exchange Cutover and Stage Migration, the Exchange Hybrid, which is probably where we spend most of the time in the end. What I don't want to do, I don't want to explain to you what Office 365 is. I expect that you know what Office 365 is, so I won't go into licensing or into the different SKUs or anything. But yeah, if you have any questions, again, feel free to talk to me later on. All right, so let's get started. I've got about 68 slides, so you will see me flicking through them quite fast. I will go through the first three topics quite fast, and then most of the time we sped into email migration. So if there's anything else, again, if there's anything you want to talk about, come up, feel free to ask questions, raise your hand, or just speak up. I'm here. Oh, yeah, if you can't understand me, let me know as well. I got a bit of a mixed accent. Originally from Germany, moved to New Zealand in 2005, then went to Asia, talked to the Asian people, and mixed up my accent a little bit, and now Australian, they just, do stuff with my accent I don't understand. Anyways, cool, so are you ready? So when we make a Office 365 migration, the decision most likely will not come from us as technical people, it will come from top down. It's all about saving cost. It's all about making sure that we don't have to buy another server, we don't have to expand our data center, we want to move away from that, we want to move into the cloud, we want to move into a service model. So the decision comes from up there, which means that for us, we need to make sure that our business is ready for Office 365. So we personally need to do our homework. Is that working? Yeah. We personally need to do our homework. So we need to look into Office 365, have a look what's out there, have a look at there as different SKUs and different options, what we can do, what we can't do, and basically be informed about it. So one of the first things to do is understand the MS Cloud principles. I'm going to flick them up later on the next slide and just go through them, make sure we understand what Microsoft does, what Microsoft doesn't provide to us, what we can do and what we can't do. We need to ensure that our network and our environment is ready. We need to make sure that our network speed, our internet bandwidth and everything is ready. We need to make sure that our PCs are up to date and that we comply with Microsoft's policy that requires us to stay up to date, basically. We should talk to our admins and our users. There's a lot of change that's going to happen to them. So if they move from on-prem to Office 365, the administrators will need to do things differently. Users might change from Office 2003, 2007 to Office 2013 Pro Plus, so they need to know how to deal with the change. So we should provide some training to them so they are all ready as well. We should review our security policies. Again, some companies might have some security policies in place that forbids them to move data offshore, so is Office 365 the right solution for them? Do we need to change anything in the security policies? Is there anything that would block us to go to Office 365? And then we have a look at our internal processes. How do we actually do stuff at the moment? How do we provision users? How will that change? How do we provision new mailboxes? How do we engage with the users? Where do we store our data? All that kind of stuff. We should have a review about that and have a look how that will change when we move to Office 365. To do all that, when we actually do the migration, we want to think about what we want to migrate. Is it just email? Is it email and data? Do we want to create a SharePoint library up there and enable users to search for it? We want to have a migration strategy, and for email we talk about that later on, but do we want to move everything in one place, or do we want to move slowly bit by bit by bit and create a hybrid? And lastly, we think about what we want to move first. So is it email? Is it data? Is it anything else? Most of the people most likely will want to migrate emails. That's the largest workload, and most of the clients that I engage with, they say that's the first workload they want to migrate. But other people might want to just move all their data storage up to OneDrive for Business or something else. So these are all the questions that you should think about. Make sure you understand them, have a go through them, and be ready, really. We go through the Microsoft Cloud principles. Number one, the services are highly configurable and scalable without customization, meaning we can configure a lot, and Microsoft provides us more and more options. But it's still in the Microsoft data center. We can't touch the physical server. We cannot install any third-party add-ons or anything for us. So it's really up to Microsoft to provide the service to us, and we need to make sure that what Microsoft provides us is okay with us and it's sufficient. Services are under the Microsoft security policy. Again, we can't enforce security policies on Microsoft. We need to be okay with what Microsoft does in terms of security. Microsoft provides transparent data location. Everybody knows where the data centers are. Gonna have a few more in Melbourne and in Sydney pretty much soon, which is first Azure, but no reason why there can't be Office 365 in the long term. Microsoft does the audit, so if you have any audit requirements, go to the Trust Center, have a look through the audit that Microsoft provides, make sure that's enough for you. If that's not enough, talk to your Microsoft account manager and have a look if you can do something. Sometimes there are ways around it, not always. Microsoft liability is capped, so if something happens, they won't pay you back everything that you lost. They are capped to 12 months of what you paid for your Office 365 service and not more. And I think it's the second to last, Office 365 is an evergreen service, meaning they will continuously roll out updates. Every month they will roll out updates to SharePoint, to Exchange. And with that, we need to make sure that we stay current as well. So Microsoft has a policy that says your Windows and your Office needs to be N-1. So with Windows 8, Windows 7 is still supported. Windows Vista, dare I say it, is not supported anymore. XP, long not. Same for Office. 2007 recently dropped off. You could still connect to it, but it's not supported anymore, meaning that if there are changes, which there are with 2013, you might have trouble connecting with a version that is not supported anymore. And the last one, it rapidly evolves, as I say, evergreen service. So there's a roadmap out there, which you can access, and it's on the next slide. Make sure you read through the roadmap, make sure you subscribe to it, have a look at the blogs, have a look what's out there, make sure it aligns to your business processes, and have a look if there's something on the roadmap that will benefit you further down the track, like the 1 terabyte storage in OneDrive for Business that recently came out, or the changes that they made last week where they enabled files larger than 2 gigabyte to be uploaded to OneDrive. So stay current. There are a couple of slides. And a couple of links, so you can download the slides later. Service description and updates, so you can download the service description. Make sure you understand Office 365. That's all that Office 365 does. There is the roadmap and the service updates up there. We got the system requirements, which will make sure that you stay up to date for your PCs. We got the Office blog up there, which is really interesting. So that's where they announce all the new features most of the times. And then we got the deployment and the Fast Track Center up there, which helps clients move to Office 365, especially with Fast Track. There are a couple of initiatives from Microsoft that allow you as a partner to engage with your client to then take some funds from Microsoft and then use that on the migration. Microsoft also announced last week that they will use the Fast Track Center for clients larger than 150 users, I think, and They basically provide more funds for these users with larger than, or for these clients with more than 150 users. All right, cool. So we moved to Office 365. First thing that we want to do as an admin is we want to make some new friends. So we have to talk to these guys over here, administrators as well. You're probably one of these, or all of them, or none of them. But when you prepare for Office 365, you need to make sure that you have these guys behind your back. They need to back you up. If you don't have the support of these guys, you probably run into problems further down the track where one of them goes, no, can't do that. So before you roll it out, make sure you have a talk to them and make sure, as I said, they are behind you. So let's talk about the networking guy. This guy most likely will ask you how much bandwidth you actually need. He will ask you when you need it. Do you need it all the time? Is there a specific peak time when you need it? And he will ask you when you migrate, because that will be the time when there is the largest bandwidth impact. For yourself, you want to know what the current bandwidth is. You want to confirm that it's sufficient. You want to have a look who your ISP is, and if your ISP does anything funky to your line. Do they do any throttling? Do they do any traffic shaping or anything that would prohibit you to do the migration? And do they peer with Microsoft? Microsoft does peer in the different locations, so make sure that your ISP peers with Microsoft. Also want to have a look at the latency. I normally go for about under 300 milliseconds to get to the Azure data center, so under 300 is normally fine. If you see anything funky or anything larger than that, you probably want to talk to your ISP and have a look why that is so. Again, a couple of links that will help you analyze all that. So we have the bandwidth requirements and the bandwidth calculators up there for Link, Exchange, SharePoint, and some network configuration information for Link Online. So look these up if you do. They'll actually help you, and they will let you or put you in a better position to then talk to the networking people. Security. Security guy is going to ask you, what do you actually access? How will the data be secured that's up there? How will the data be secured while we're moving it up there? And does it actually work with our current security policies? So again, we have to analyze that. What you want to know from the security guy is how things work at the moment. So you want to know, what is our existing proxy internet access rules? Is there anything at the moment in there that would prohibit certain users to actually access the internet? Some users are not able or not allowed to go online. They might be blocked from Facebook. They might be blocked from anything. So would that actually interfere with us allowing our users access to Office 365? You want to ask them if there's any multi-factor authentication in place. Do we have any current identity providers? Do we use ADFS already? Do we use Shibboleth? Do we use anything else, SAML, that we might want to integrate further down the track? And then we're going to talk to them about the firewall and the proxies, make sure that they're compatible. What you want to look for is that the firewall and the proxies do support DNS whitelisting, which will make your life a lot easier. If they're not, we can whitelist the IPs. But it's always good to just get to know what firewall and proxy is in place so we can write that down and then further down the track look it up why we have problems. Again, we have a couple of more information up there. So the Office 365 URLs and IP addresses, Exchange Online URLs and IP addresses, the RSS feed that will update you with it. And then you can point your security guy to the Trust Center, which has all the audit information, basically everything that they need to know in regards to their security policy. So they can read through that. They can make sure that they're fine with it and then get back to you. And the last guy is the admins. So they're quite important as well, because for them, probably everything changes. They will need to change how they provision the users. They will need to change how they provision their mailboxes for the users. They will need to know how to deploy everything on site, how to deploy Office Pro Plus and everything. So they need to know how the new system works, so they need to go training and everything. What you want to know from them is everything that you need to know for the actual migration. So you want to know everything around the domain OU structure. What forest functional level do you have at the moment? What domain functional level do you have at the moment? Is there anything special in there? Do you have any special AD extensions that might block you, or that are just there and you got no idea what they're doing? You also want to ask them, what is the current provisioning and deprovisioning method of users? quite funnily, I had a client with about 40,000 AD objects, and 35 of those were old users that were not there anymore, but they were still in AD. That caused a couple of problems. And we want to ask them about the current UPNs, and that's just information that we need later on. Again, a few more slides. Just the Virtual Academy, always good for the admins. Tells you everything about it. We got the Admin Resource Center, more information for them. There's just Office 365 training, typical training. Ignite is up there. Ignite is a great resource for presentations like this. And we have the Office 365 Summit, which was released yesterday. It's a news website, and they're going to publish Office 365 Summit, similar to Ignite, on there that are worldwide. Cool. So that's the thing that we need to look into if you want to get ready for Office 365. I'll give you a chance to raise any questions at the moment. If not, talk to me later on. As I said, I'm going to go through the first two topics quite fast. Anybody? No? Cool. Sweet. He's smiling. Wellington. Phoenix. No? Talk about identity. So all the identity in Office 365, all the identity options that we have, they're now all based on Windows Azure Active Directory. Didn't used to be the way, but they changed that about 3 years ago. So we have three methods of identity, or three options to use identity. We have cloud only, cloud identities. Nothing is on-prem, everything is in the cloud. Perfect if you have a five-user company. They don't have AD, they don't have nothing on-premises. They really want to go just into Office 365. Perfect for them. Then we have the option to use directory synchronization. If you have a company that has Active Directory on-premises and they want to use their current AD, their current GAL and everything, then we use DirSync, which is great, and it's a one tool. It requires one server. Microsoft changed it that you can now actually install it on a AD controller as well, so we don't actually need to provision another server if we have an SPS server or something similar. And then we have federated identities, which means we have ADFS in place, or we have Shibboleth in place, or something else that would allow us to move the authentication mechanism from Office 365, where it is for cloud identities and for directory sync, down to our on-premises network, where all the authentication will then actually happen in our local data center. So what's the rule to find the right one for you, or how can we choose which one we should actually go for? Rule is really choose the simplest one that's fit for you. If you don't have an AD, there's no reason why you can't just go for cloud identities. It's great if you don't have any on-premises server, which in future there will be a lot more companies that actually don't have any on-premises hardware. They can just go cloud identities and it works perfectly for them. They can then also choose to integrate Azure Active Directory via single sign-on with other cloud services out there, so it's really good for them. If you do have an on-premises Active Directory and you have enough users, so if you have more than 5 users or 10 users, go for the directory synchronization tool. It's great. Works. Just sits there. If it breaks down, there's a way to back it up. There's a way to make it not highly available, but you can make it available in a nearly highly available state, and I'm going to talk about that tomorrow if you got time. But yeah, that works pretty sweet. And the password hash thing that they brought out is pretty good if you want to provide a same sign-on experience to your users without actually needing to install ADFS. In fact, ADFS used to be installed mainly to get that same password for cloud identities and the AD identities together. So in the initial ADFS deployments over the first 2.5 years before the password sync came out, most of these were deployed so that the companies could provide a same sign-on experience to their users. So with the password sync that Microsoft provided over the last year now, we don't actually have the need to provide ADFS anymore, unless we have a couple of specific scenarios, which is on the next slide. But password sync works perfectly. If you have questions about that, what the difference is, just come to me afterwards and we talk about it. But yeah, that's quite fine. But when do we actually want to use ADFS? So there are three reasons. If we have existing infrastructure, if we have technical requirements, or if we have policy requirements. So existing infrastructure, we already have an ADFS deployment in place, so no reason why we shouldn't use it. We already have a different identity provider in place. We have Shippolet, we have a SAML infrastructure that we want to use. We can do that. Or we have Forefront Identity Manager 2010 in place, which is basically the same thing as Stirsync. So if we have that in place, we want to use that as well. On the technical requirements, if you have a multiple forest in your on-premises AD and you want to use multiple forests, if you have multiple ADs, if you want to do something like splitting up two of your local domains into multiple tenants, if you want to move two different exchange forests into one tenant, that's reasons when you want to use ADFS. Also want to use ADFS if you have any sort of multi-factor authentication, if you have any custom hybrid applications that need to be able to authenticate against each other. So if you have a SharePoint hybrid that needs to be able to talk to each other, needs to be able to search each other, you most likely want to deploy ADFS. And then seven is if you want to provide your users with a method how they can reset the password by themselves. So with ADFS, we have the option to provide a password reset web page. It's not password changing, it's password reset, meaning that if your user logs on a couple of times with the wrong password, they would be able to click on that link and then change the password. G'day. Hey. Policy requirements, last one. You require single sign-on for auditing. You have the requirement to immediately disable a user's account if that person leaves. Want to go for ADFS? You want to provide single sign-on, and again, single sign-on and same sign-on is a little bit different, mainly around how the authentication works. Great presentation tomorrow, if got time. I'll let you know about that tomorrow. If you want to restrict your clients to knock log on after office hours, I'm not sure who does that, but some people do. And if your policies, your audit policies, your security policies prevent you from actually synchronizing the password hash into Azure AD, which is can be a requirement, it's a little bit, I don't like that requirement, but can be a requirement. Basically what it does with the hash is when you save your password in your AD locally, that hash gets already encrypted and everything. So we then take that hash, we run another encryption over it, A512, and then move it up to Office 365, and it's already encrypted up there, so it's quite secure to move it up there for a password sync. That was identity. As I said, gonna move quite fast. If you want to know more about identity, if you're really keen to know about multiple forests, multiple Office 365 tenants, getting that all together, come to the session tomorrow. This one at 10:40, I think, up there, next room. And that session will talk about multiple forests, how we can move them together, what the new syncs are between the DirSync tool and the Azure Active Directory Synchronization tool, what the differences are, what they are capable of and everything. So come to the session tomorrow. That's a 1-hour deep dive just into directory synchronization and federation. But let's move to the most important topic, mail migrations. In Office 365, if we want to move our mail to Office 365, depending from where we want, basically have four options. We have one option if we have a non-Exchange server, if we have Lotus Notes, if we have Gmail, if we have Hotmail, if we have anything else. The native tool that we have is basically an IMAP migration. Besides that, there are third-party tools out there. There's Migration Wars. For Lotus Notes, there would be the Quest tools. There really are heaps and heaps of third-party tools out there that would help you moving from a non-Exchange environment into Office 365. But the actual native tool that Microsoft provides is just the IMAP migration. And then we have three ways to migrate from an Exchange environment, Exchange 2003 plus. So we have a cutover migration, stage migration, and a hybrid. And as I said, we're going to move into that a little bit further. Now, besides these options, we also have a little bit more of a manual approach. And that's great if you have a small company, if you have three people, if you have four people or five people. You can do a user-centric approach. You can have a user-driven approach and an admin-driven approach. So the user-driven approach, there are basically three ways. We just give them a new mailbox and we don't worry about their emails at all. It works sometimes. It works if you have people that are not really that important. You're laughing. Just a stupid thing, but like I worked for a retail company and they basically moved out emails to all of their retail personnel, which there were 25,000 people. So these people, they didn't really need the last emails where they sent emails to each other saying, hey, what do you want to have for Friday for lunch? So they basically just dropped that and said, okay, cool, we don't want to go into all the problems with moving those 25,000 people. Then we could provide them with a new mailbox and just attach the Outlook PST file, or we can give them a new mailbox and we can use connected accounts to create an iMAPI or a MAPI connection to their existing Gmail account or to their existing Hotmail account, Outlook account, Lotus Notes, whatever they want to have, CC Mail, things out there. That's possible and that's working quite well. Needs to be done via OWA, and it's a good solution for or a working solution if you don't want to spend that much time on it. You can also do an admin-driven migration where you would have the PST Capture tool. PST Capture tool is a tool that you can install on your user client's PCs. It allows you to scan through the C drive, D drive. If it finds a PST file, it will then take the PST file and move it to a local server. And from there, from that local server, you have the option to then take that PST file and move it into a specific user's mailbox in Office 365 or even into their archive. So you could install the tool, roll it out via AD, roll it out via MSI, get it scanning, capture all the PST files, move them into a central location, and then move it up into Office 365 without actually needing to go through any other tools. All right. Again, how do we decide what option to choose? What's our decision factors? So it really depends on your organization. Every organization is different. And again, you have this organization where some people aren't that important, so you're going to go down that way, or you have the organization where everything needs to be kept and everything needs to be highly secure, so you go down the more complex way. But in general, we have five things that we need to look at. Where's the email coming from? How big is the organization? 5 people, 50,000 people. Do we have any coexistent requirements? And then in the coexistent requirements, do they need to have all the features or not? How do we provision the users? And again, that goes back into identity. Do we use DoSync? Are we provisioning them manually or do we have any other automated way? And how do we manage the identity? Is it on-premises, single sign-on, or cloud? Again, if we have a third party or if we have a non-Exchange server, most likely you want to go down the IMAP migration way or a third party tool. If we have an Exchange server, we have another way that we need to look into. So we basically have the cutover, the staged, and the hybrid approach to move emails. So we're going to look at the organization. We have a look. How many people are there? Are there 100 people? Can we move 100 people within a weekend? Is that possible? 100 gigabyte? 200 gigabyte, 300 gigabyte, yeah, that should be possible. That's quite easy. So we probably want to go down a way as fast as possible. Big bang, move them all over weekend, and they come in on Monday. Everything should be migrated. So cutover is great for small clients where we have a week or less. If we have larger clients, if we have 200, 300, 400, 500, a couple of thousand users, we look into a staged migration. What we want to look into is, yes, we know it's going to take a while. It's probably going to take a month, maybe 2 months. It's going to take a while to migrate them all. What we want to have a look at is what kind of interactivity do the people want that are already migrated to the people that are still on premises. Is it fine if they, do they need to have things like free busy lookup, or do they need to have things like calendar sharing? Or is it fine if we go, we migrate Department A first, have all the PAs in there, make sure that the PAs can look up all the calendars that they normally access. And then move Department B, Department C, Department D, and basically just give them the basic functionality of being able to email each other and have the mail flow working. If they need more, if they do need rich coexistence, so if they do need to be able to look at everybody's calendar, if they do need to be able to have a look at the mail tips, what else is there? Calendar sharing, mail tips, free busy, have a look at the same goal, those kind of things. If you want that, then you go down the hybrid way. And hybrid is then 2010 and 2013.
the requirements. It's quite easy normally. That's cool. Any questions at the moment? No, everybody's quiet. All shy. That's cool. All right, so all of these migrations, they all work in the same way. And I do have a couple of demos later on and show you. But all of these migrations do work in the same way, and they're all being done via the new migration mailbox wizard, which is in Office 365 in the Exchange Admin Center. So you log on into your Office 365, go admin, Exchange, go under recipients. If you can see there, yep, recipients, go to migrations, and then you have the option to click on the plus symbol, which then gives you the option to choose what kind of migration you want to use. So, and there you can see the remote move, which is hybrid. We can see the stage migration, we can see the cutover migration, we can see the IMAP migration. So based on what we decided, what migration option you want to choose, we select that. We can also do that via, just going to go back, go in there, choose it. It will then prompt us to deliver some sort of information. So for IMAP stage and cutover, it will ask us what are the user's information that we want to migrate. So you provide a CSV. The CSV will have information about the user's email address, the user's username and password, or you have to have an admin username and password that can access that specific mailbox. And then we'll just try to connect it first via auto-discovery. If that fails, it will ask you for the location of the server. And the IMAP address. And then it basically will just try to connect to it. We'll go through a couple of tests, make sure it can connect to it, make sure it can access the server and everything. And it then moves it over to Office 365. And again, I'll go through all these in the next couple of slides, but yeah. PowerShell is available, so if you're bored, you can write some PowerShell scripts and do it via PowerShell. Great tool if you do a lot of batch migrations. So if you know you have a stage migration with 15,000 users, and you want to use Department A, Department B, Department C, you can write your PowerShell script, so you only have to press enter, and you don't have to go through the GUI anymore. Things to remember about the new mailbox move wizard. Yep, it's the one-stop shop, so you always go there if you want to do a migration, except if you do it via PowerShell, but that's where you go first time. Microsoft now supports the auto-discover feature for cutover stage and hybrid. It doesn't do it for the IMAP migration. So for IMAP migration, you still need to point it to the right server. It's the same wizard for on-premises mailbox moves, and that means for the hybrid move. And it has a lot of alerting and stuff in there that you can look up if things go wrong. Cool. So that's email migrations in general, and now we go down and go drill down into the IMAP and everything else. Anything else before we drill down? Yes? No. So that would be up to you to then say, okay, cool. It depends how you name your PST files. If you have your Outlook profiles and your Outlook profiles are named in a specific way, that's what the PST files normally should be named. So you would go down that way. But it wouldn't be able to go into the PST file and then have a look who actually owns the PST. That's not possible. I know that the Quest tool for Lotus Notes do that. So the Lotus Notes equivalent, which would be NSF files, they have an owner. So if you would do a Lotus Notes migration, there's a similar tool that would allow you to go into the NSF file, have a look who's the owner, and then move it up to that person. But the PST capture tool doesn't do that now. Oh, yep. So that's if you want to move between a small business SKU to a enterprise SKU. I would use a third-party tool. I would use MigrationWiz to do that.
But the roadblocks that I've run into is that you've got to release
the SMTP domains. Yes, correct, yes.
And so you've got to create all these temporary mailboxes.
Correct. So what he's referring to is that he wants to migrate a mailbox from a mid-sized Office 365 client into an enterprise client. Office 365, you can only verify your domain in one of the tenants. It doesn't let you verify the domain in both tenants at the same time. So his problem is that he needs to disable the domain on one of the tenants first. You can convert it into cloud mailboxes. So you know how you have your tenant name.onmicrosoft.com? So you can convert. Yes, yep. So you have to delete the domain from the tenant and then activate it on the other one. So you need to have a period of time where you can move that. What I would do in that specific thing, what I would do is I would create a bigger Exchange server. There are third-party providers out there that let you point your MX record to them. They would then just store all the emails that comes in and would put it into a queue. And as long as they can't deliver that email, they would just keep the queue and keep the emails. So I would then do that. I would point the MX record to them first. Telstra used to do that, and then delete it, enable it up there, move it over, enable all the mail, move it via migration bus.
So is Microsoft doing any research into making the process easier?
Not that I know, no. 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 Unfortunately, not that I know. All right, moving on to the IMAP migration. IMAP is quite easy, so that's just two or three slides. What can we do with IMAP? So we can migrate all the mail messages, we can migrate all the inboxes and the other folders in there. Maximum of 50,000 items. Need to make sure that you don't have more than that. Depending how old that mailbox is, might have more. It's possible to exclude specific folders, so you can say, okay, I want to migrate everything except the deleted items, or except the chunk email, so you don't have to worry about that. But what it can't do the contacts, the calendars, the tasks, anything else that is in Outlook, so it will only do the mail, really. If you want to migrate contacts, calendar, tasks, look into third-party tools. Again, Migration Wiz, which is my favorite tool if I want to do that. But there are other providers out there that help you along that way. Also can't migrate folders that have a /, and it can't migrate emails larger than 25 megabyte, which is actually an Office 365 limitation because it doesn't allow you to have more emails in there. That's really all up to IMAP. That's how it is. That's what you do. I think I mixed up my slides a little bit. IMAP requirements limitations. For the IMAP, you don't need to have anything on-premises, so everything is in Office 365. You just connect it to your IMAP port, or you connect it to your IMAP point, whatever that is, Gmail, Hotmail, Lotus Notes. Connect to it, sucks out all the email, puts it into the Office 365 mailbox, and then goes on. What you do need to do is you need to provision the users beforehand, so you need to know what the users are. So you get an export of the tenant. So in Gmail, you will need to write it down because there's no way to connect to it. But if you have Lotus Notes, anything on premises, you will normally be able to just run some sort of script and it will give you a list of the mailboxes. You then can either collect the username and password from the users themselves, or you can, if you can, create an admin mailbox that has access to all of them. You should look into that and do that. If you do the admin way, when you create a CSV file, depending on where you, probably should look at that, depending on where you migrate from. So if you migrate from Gmail or if you migrate from Exchange, when you type in the username, you might need to type in contoso/ or / administrator / Terry Adams. For Gmail, it's something like, I think it's / administrator, / username, and then the administrator password. So it will depend on the IMAP system that you migrate from, how you create a CSV file. But it's well documented in Office 365. So if you Google up Gmail migration Office 365 administrator, it will tell you how to create the CSV file itself. This example up here, that's basically having the username and password of the user up here. So I have the actual email address, I have the username, and I have the password. Save it as a CSV file, and that's the CSV file that I would then use in the Exchange migration wizard to say, these are the mailboxes that I want to migrate. Just go back to this one. So we need to have the users migrated. So we get that list out of the mail client that we have. then provision them. We can do that via PowerShell, which is the best option in my opinion, or you can do it via the CSV import tool in Office 365 as well if you want to. We need to have all the SMTP domains already in the Office 365 tenant. Need to have the credentials to talk about that, and then we need to have the CSV file. The migration flow is like this. So we provision the users, mailboxes, the DNS names and everything. We gather the IMAP credentials. We put everything into the wizard. The wizard does an initial sync. And then afterwards, it does a sync every 24 hours. So if there's an email coming in afterwards, after 24 hours, as long as we don't click on finish, it will still sync those emails. Then once we have migrated all the users and we're comfortable, we change the MX record. Once the MX record is changed and we see emails flowing into the actual mailboxes, we mark the migration as complete, which causes it to do another final synchronization, and then all the emails are there. Questions to IMAP? Nope. So IMAP, because IMAP can do quite a large number of users as well. It depends on your requirements. So if you have a client that has 1,000 Gmail users, you can use IMAP to do that. If you have a large client that has IMAP, you most likely are better off to use the third-party tool because you want to provide a better option for them to migrate their calendars and everything as well. But besides that, IMAP works quite well for only mail-centric clients. Going into the Exchange version, so going into Exchange cutover and stage migration. Cutover and stage migration, they're very, very similar. They both use MAPI again. The difference is that they are able to get more information from Exchange, get more information around the user context and the distribution groups and all that kind of stuff. The difference between cutover and stage migration is that on the stage migration, we have a dosync server on-premises. So when we have the dosync server on-premises, all the AD information will be synchronized via dosync. In a cutover scenario, we don't have dosync. We can't actually do a cutover migration if we have dosync installed. So in a cutover scenario, we would have the Exchange migration wizard, or the mailbox move wizard, connecting to Exchange via MAPI. It then uses another protocol, NSPI, to connect to the GAL via the Exchange server, and then it grabs all the distribution list users and the contacts from Exchange or from the GAL via Exchange and moves it up to Office 365. So the migration scope is that we can now move not just the mail, but we can also move the contacts and the tasks and everything else in the calendar. We can move rules and categories, which is quite good. We can move the out-of-office settings, can move the delegates and folder permissions, and we can move some of the Outlook settings. What we can't do is we can't move security groups because that's not in the GAL. We can't move dynamic distribution lists because they're not really compatible between each other. Can't move the system mailboxes because they're specific to the Exchange server itself. Can't move the dumpster. So the dumpster is if you delete an email, it goes into your deleted folders, and you delete it out of the deleted folders, it goes into your dumpster, and then depending on your configuration, it stays in the dumpster between 15 and X days, where X is whatever you specify. So we can't migrate the emails that are in the dumpster. And we can't migrate the send as permission via that method. And again, we have the message larger than 25 megabytes. A few specifics to the cutover Exchange migration. So it's a simple Exchange migration. It's for small and medium-sized businesses. So anybody in New Zealand that has an SBS server, that's perfect for them if you don't want to go down the dosync way. Shouldn't be more than 1,000 users. And that's probably more like a how fast can you move it. So with cutover, you want to migrate them all in a specific time period where you say, oh, cool, I'll do it over a weekend. I'll migrate 50 users, 100 users. 150 users, 1,000 users is probably quite tight. If you think about the average mailbox size of a gigabyte, you would move a terabyte up. That's probably where your limitation comes in, like how fast can you actually move all the data up to Office 365. So you want to make sure that you can do it in the time frame that you specified. It uses Outlook Anywhere, which means that we need to have a public certificate on the Outlook Anywhere endpoint. So in Exchange, if we have mail.clientname.com, we need to make sure that there is a certificate behind it. If you don't have one, buy one from GoDaddy and use it. Spend those additionally $90, you're better off having a real certificate. It won't work with a publicly or with a self-signed certificate at all. Identity management is in the cloud, at least initially, so we are using the cutover migration and SPI to get the information from the Exchange server, have all the users, contacts, and everything populated in Office 365. After the cutover, we can enable DirSync, and we then use SMTP soft matching to match up the whatever is on premises with everything that is in Office 365. But in the beginning, it is cloud only. And capabilities, we don't need to install anything on-prem, so those clients that don't want to deploy another DirSync server, we can migrate from Exchange 2003 or higher. We can migrate from hosted Exchange solutions, which I think there are not too many in New Zealand. As I said, it automatically provisions the users, and it does move everything except the few little things that I did. Migration looks like this, so we have the MAPI control, or the MAPI protocol, that will allow us to move mail from the Exchange server to Office 365, and then we use NSPI to move the users' contacts groups via the GAL that connects to AD up to Office 365 as well. Again, accounts and passwords. Accounts are provisioned during the migration. The passwords, we can't get to the passwords via the GAL, so we don't have access to that. So during the migration, the wizard will create some temporary passwords. It will then send an email to the administrator that you specify in the wizard. And then you get that email with, hey, these are the usernames, these are the passwords, and you then have to give that to your users. When users log on for the first time, they will need to change their password. So they need to log on via the portal. They can't just go into Outlook and try to configure it because it won't allow you to change the password. So you need to go into the portal first, get them to change the password. And then we need to get them to recreate the Outlook profile and re-download all the emails as well. That was funky. cool. Distraction there. State Exchange migration. It's pretty much the same thing as the cutover, except that we now use the DirSync server. So we have the DirSync server on premises. We use the DirSync server to move all the AD users and groups and contacts up to Office 365. Besides that, we still connect via Outlook anywhere. We still need that public certificate. We can still migrate 2003 and 2007. We can't do a stage migration with 2010 and 2013. That's a funky thing because when you have 2010 and 2013 installed, the DirSync tool would see that and it would actually lock down all other migration options but the hybrid option. And by lockdown, I'll say actually just the stage migration option. So if you have DirSync installed and you try to do a stage migration, it will fail because it will try to set a target address, which it can't do anymore. There's some technical limitations. So if you have 2010 or 2013, don't try to do a staged exchange migration. It will always fail. Always go down and do the hybrid, which is easy because already they have 2010 in place. Staged exchange migration, because we are using DirSync, we can now do a simple coexistence method, which allows us to just migrate a few people at a time, so we can have batches of people that be like, cool, going to move five people, going to migrate the CEO with all his PAs and the CEO and all the important people up to Office 365 first, make sure they're up there and they're working fine and everything works fine. And then we're going to start with the IT department, move the IT department, move sales, and then move everybody else. So that's possible, and I'm going to go into a way how that works later down. Again, it allows you to migrate everything, mail, calendar tasks, and everything else that there's in Exchange, in Outlook. And it looks like this. Again, we use DirSync to move up the user contacts in the groups, and we use MAPI and NSPI to get the mailbox data. The accounts and the passwords, again, it's done via DirSync. Because we are using DirSync, we can now use the password synchronization to make sure that the users can use the same password. So we don't need to distribute the usernames and passwords to users. If we don't have the password sync option enabled, it will do the same thing that it does in cutover. It will send you an email with the new usernames and passwords, and you will then need to go in there and change it. Interesting thing in the stage migration is that if you do not have a, if you want to migrate a user that currently doesn't have an Exchange mailbox, you have to create the Exchange mailbox first. So you have to make that user in AD a mail-enabled user first before you move it, or before you can actually migrate the mail. So you can't just say, okay, cool, I'm going to create, I want to move somebody that's actually not there, and then get this email from somebody else. So you need to make that user a mail-enabled user first. I only know one way to dance to that, and given that I'm German, I shouldn't do that. migration scope. Partial migrations are not possible. We can't exclude folders. We can't put time ranges in place, which we are be able in a hybrid scenario. We have to migrate everything. We can't migrate mailboxes that are enabled for unified messaging. And the OST file cannot be preserved. What's happening there is that the two Exchange forests, they're different forests, they're two different Exchange organizations. If you have a mailbox, it has a specific mailbox ID in forest A. And when we create the mailbox in the Exchange forest online, or in the Exchange online forest, we create another mailbox that has a different ID. Because they have different IDs, the OST file won't let you connect to the other mailbox, it's just not possible. So you will need to re-download, or you will need to create a new user profile, and then you will need to re-download all your emails as well while you're creating the profile. That's cool. Migration flow. We configure Outlook anywhere on the Exchange server, so we have to put in the certificate and everything. Then we test it. If you don't know the Exchange Remote Analyzer tool, Google it, or I can give it to you later. It's a great tool to test everything. And then we assign the admin permission to an administrator user that we then use to migrate everybody. So we basically create a new administration migration user. We assign the right, correct Exchange rights and Exchange, and then we use that user to move all the mail. Open up the wizard, put in the CSV file. Then the users will either be created via the AD or via the user provisioning in the CEM, via the tool. Do initial sync, do the del sync 24/7, just like IMAP. Once we are fine that everything is being migrated, once we know all the users have been migrated, we change the MX record. Mark the migration as complete again, and then do a last final synchronization. Clean up and then let the users or license the users. So the thing to remember is that you actually won't, in a cutover migration, you won't use Office 365 till everybody is up there. In a staged migration, the users can already use Office 365 while some are still on premises. Mailflow is coming up in a second. Cutover versus staged. Cutover is designed for smaller clients. You want to move everything at once, so you want to make sure that you can actually move everything at once. If you think that you're limited on your bandwidth, you probably want to go down the stage migration path. It's basically good. Don't want to tweet out everything. So that's cutover versus staged. Because we said we have a simple mail flow or simple coexistence if we have a staged migration. This is the way how it actually works. So before we have the staged migration, we basically have a user that sends an email. The other person's mail server will look up the MX record, sends it to the Exchange server on-premise to us. Then the Exchange server will look up the mailbox, and it will deliver the mail. Boom. If we have a staged migration, we have dosing in place, and because we have dosing in place, we now have an option to change specific AD attributes or add specific AD attributes. So one of the attributes that we're looking for is this target address. It's already there. It's an extension of Exchange. So when we actually migrate, or when we actually migrate a user from Exchange on-premises to Exchange Online, what we do in Exchange and what we do Exchange on-premise, we're going to set that target address to be the cloud identity, to be username at contosa.onmicrosoft.com. So then if somebody from external sends an email, and it will look up at Exeter code, it will go to our Exchange server first. The Exchange server says, okay, cool, that email is for johndoe@contosa.com. But really, he has a target address set, and that target is contosa.mail.onmicrosoft.com. So the Exchange server now knows that he needs to move that to a different Exchange organizations. So it would look up the MX record for contosa.mail.onmicrosoft.com. It would get delivered into Office 365. And then the Office 365 Exchange server does the same thing. It will look up who was that email addressed to, contosa.mail.onmicrosoft.com. We'll try to find that user in its own directory, so in the Azure AD. And once it found it, we'll move it into that mailbox. Same thing happening if you send one from on-premises. So if Jane sends an email to Joe, Joe is already in Exchange Online, so it goes to the Exchange server on-premises. Exchange server on-premises checks the email address and checks the target address, and then looks up MX record, moves it over to Office 365. Again, Office 365 looks into the directory and then delivers the email. And last one, same thing. We have John Doe. John now sends an email to Jane. It would send an email to Exchange Online. Exchange Online looks up the email address for Jane, and Jane doesn't have the target address set to contosa@onmicrosoft.com. Jane still has the target address set to @contosa.com. So the Exchange Online server now knows that it's not responsible for contosa.com. It knows it needs to send it off to Office to the on-premises server, looks up the MX record, and sends it over. So for us, that means that till we actually finish the migration, the Exchange Online server doesn't feel responsible for the actual domain that we have. It knows that there's another Exchange server that it's on-premises, and it knows that all the emails to contosa.com actually need to go still on-premises. Once we actually finish the staged migration, it will then take over that, and it knows, okay, cool, that's me. I need to look after that. This one? Oh, this one?
Yeah, yeah. What's the significance of mail?
No. It's just these are both created. It's kind of legacy. So in the beginning, when we had the hybrids, one of them was the actual user identity, and the other one was the routing, or the routing one. So one of them would have been used to log on. So you would use contosa.onmicrosoft.com to log on to Office 365. And back in that, it wasn't Azure AD. It was the previous directory. So it used that. And then mail.onmicrosoft.com would have been the actual MX record, or the actual domain that was used to move over. So it is legacy. It's still used, though. Finally, if you use either of them, possible arrive nowadays. All right, let's go in the fun part. It's time. Hybrid member migrations, and I'm probably going to go really fast. Hybrid is complex exchange migration solutions for large-sized organizations that do want to have things like FreeBSD, calendar sharing, mail tips, single overall. You can migrate both ways. So if you have a requirement to be able to move mailboxes back on premises, then you definitely want to deploy a hybrid. You also want to do message tracking. It does require directory sync, so you need to have directory sync in place. Also requires auto discovery, so again, you need the public certificate. And it works with 2003, 2007, 2010, and 2013. Basically makes your migration really easy. The way how it works is that it actually has open authentication, delegated authentication on there, which then allows the Exchange on-premises server to talk to the Exchange Online server. Between that, they can create some sort of trust, and then they trust each other. And between that, they can make sure that they are in the same exchange organization. Because they're in the same exchange organization, we then have those other features that we normally wouldn't have. And because we have the trust, we can enable things like mail tips and everything else. We can also do the online mailbox move, and we have a secure mail flow. The secure mail flow basically means that all the emails between the exchange on-premises server and the exchange online server are encrypted. If somebody would intercept that, they wouldn't be able to read that. And we have an integrated admin experience, meaning that we have the one exchange portal. Everything that we do is from the one exchange portal. Running a little bit out of time, so I'm running a little bit faster. Exchange hybrid server roles, we have DirSync, we have the legacy exchange servers, and again, that can be 2003, 2007, 2010, or 2013. One thing to note there, if this is still 2003, you do not want to deploy a 2013 hybrid server, you actually want to deploy a 2010 SP3 server as your hybrid server. It will make your life a little bit easier. But for everything other than 2003, you should use the 2013 server now. Deployment process, sign up, register your domain, deploy Office 365 directory things, install the hybrid server, publish your hybrid server, and next slide is a little bit more detailed, and then run the hybrid with it. Cool. Again, I'm sorry, I have to speed up a little bit. First thing, we have to prepare the environment. So we need to make sure that we have the latest service pack and the latest cumulative updates on all the Exchange servers that are on-premises. That's mainly to make sure that these servers are compatible with the 2013 and 2010 server. Once that is in place, we deploy the Exchange 2013 server. You only need to deploy the CAS server. You do not deploy the MBX as said here. It depends on your requirements if you want to do so. You get the certificates. Make sure that the certificates that are on Exchange 2013 are the same certificates as on 2010 and 2007. So if you get new certificates, make sure you move those certificates over and activate them on the old servers as well. You publish the protocol, so you publish the Exchange web services and the SMTP endpoints, so we can actually connect to them. You can, again, verify that by the connectivity analyzer. And then you actually change your auto-discover over to Exchange 2013. From that point on, your clients would actually connect to 2013, which then moves it over to the mailbox role and makes sure that the connections between 2007 and 2013 are fine. We then run the hybrid configuration wizard, and then we move the people. Gonna skip this slide. It's cool. So I wanted to show you the actual hybrid configuration wizard. So I got a little video here. Hope that plays. And I probably need to skip that. So on the that's how you actually would do the hybrid configuration wizard. So you log on to your Exchange Admin Center. So this is Exchange 2013. It's all web-based now, so you don't have the EMC or anything anymore. And you can see up here, you actually have the Enterprise and you have Office 365. So if you have integrated, you could actually switch between Enterprise and Office 365. You can also see that under Servers, I have it integrated in my organization, so I have the old Exchange server and the new Exchange server. And this is really how you now run the Exchange wizard. You click on Enable. It will require you to sign into Office 365, so it will be able to connect to Office 365 and get the information from Office 365. And it will ask you for credentials for the Exchange Online server, for the Exchange on-premises server, so I can set up everything. If you don't have ADFS, you need to create a DNS entry. You can choose if you want to use the client access to mailbox server or if you want to use an Edge server. So there's an option to use 2010 as an Edge server now, which there previously wasn't. After that, you will choose the Exchange 2013 server as the receiving CAS. On the next one, you want to use the Exchange 2013 server as the sending mailbox server as well. And then it goes away and it does a whole lot of configuration in the background. what it actually does is that back in was 2010, pre-SP1 or pre-SP2, we had a 72-page document that would run through about 150 PowerShell commandlets, and it would configure all kinds of stuff in the background between Exchange and Exchange Online. You would need to have Exchange Online PowerShell open, and you have to Exchange PowerShell open, and you would type something in here and type something in there. They all streamlined it in Exchange 2010 Service Pack 2. So in Exchange 20 Service Pack 2, you had two wizards. You had one wizard that would create the configuration, write it into Active Directory, and then you had the second wizard that would read the configuration and then set up Exchange Online and Exchange on-premises for the configuration. But now it's all in that one wizard. So the one wizard will read the configuration from Exchange Online, it will read the configuration from Exchange on-prem, move it into the Active Directory attribute, read it from there, and then configure everything. Skip that. Cool. I think I got four more slides. Exchange Admin Center, that's the one where you go. That's the place to go. That's where you want to do everything. It's pretty simple once you see it, go through it a couple of times. We're going to skip this. We're going to skip the mail flow. Mail flow basically means that you can choose how you want to have your mail flow. You can route your mail flow in the beginning through your on-premises environment. Or later down the track, you can switch it over to Exchange on-premises or online protection, and you can route your mail via Exchange online protection. Similar to outbound, you can choose how you want to route it. So you could choose to say, I want to have all my email delivered via Exchange on-prem, or I want to have all my emails being sent out via Exchange on-prem or Exchange online protection. Things to remember. Everything is encrypted. We can't put a third-party tool between the Exchange on-premises and Exchange Online. That's not possible. And we can choose how we want to route our email. That's fine. As I said, if you have Exchange 2010 still on-premises, you can use that to connect to Office 365, the old wave and the new wave. The old wave doesn't exist anymore. If you have 2003, use Exchange 2010. And then that's probably the last slide. There are a couple of new things coming with Exchange 2010 2013 SP1, which now allows you to actually have multiple resource forests and multiple accounting forests moving into one Office 365 tenant that will come out with Exchange Service Pack 1. All right, last slide. Summary, do your homework. Make sure you understand everything. Choose the easiest identity model that works for you. The new Office 365 support range to move into the cloud, make sure you know what you want to do. Hybrid is more flexible, and Exchange Admin Center is the one stop. Related content. If you want to move know more about the identity, I can't see it in here. There is one session tomorrow which talks about multiple forests and multiple tenants and how you can make that all work, so make sure if you have questions around that to go there. If you have any other questions, come to me. I'll stick around. I love coffee, so I can come and go for coffee with you guys. Feel free to email me, and I'll see you around.